Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today's episode is going to be a hopefully not too long kind of offshoot from our conversation last week about the decline in birth rates and the kind of consequences and potential reasons that people have speculated about why few people are having fewer and fewer children. And one of the things we didn't really mention is the idea that people might be having fewer children because they are choosing to have fewer children, because they might even believe that having children is no longer a good thing to do. A position which is sometimes kind of philosophically known as antinatalism. Have you come across this idea before, Dave?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is antenatal in my world means, you know, antenatal care. And we're all in favour of it. And it's all about caring for a baby in the womb before birth and caring for the mother.
So this is A-N-T-E.
That's right, antinatalism. But this is A-N-T-I. Against natalism.
Against birth, yes.
So as a neonatologist, of course, I have a bit of a problem here because I really can't be a dyed-in-the-wood antinatalist, otherwise my whole profession becomes moribund.
Yeah, and we should put up front, we're going to be, you know, lay our cards on the table. Obviously, by definition, you're a father to me and to other people. You're not an antinatalist. I'm also a father. I'm not an antinatalist. So we don't approach this with total objectivity. We should be clear. But I think it's a really interesting philosophical movement, particularly as we mentioned last week. It seems to be almost paradoxical that it's arising at the same time when people are having fewer and fewer children, and there is a kind of pronatalist movement. You know, and you might have people, you know, famously Elon Musk has now got 13 or 14 children, I think, and says he intends to carry on. Particularly on the kind of conservative end of the political spectrum, you're increasingly coming across people who say actually we have a kind of moral obligation to have as many children as possible to try and repopulate the world and turn around this decline towards in birth rates. And at the same time, there's a different group of people saying no, we should stop having children altogether. It is immoral to have children.
Yeah, and it is interesting just to take a historical perspective, because certainly what I remember from my time, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, was that the general feeling was that it was selfish not to have children at all. It would be, you know, in general, it was a socially good thing to have children. Although there were concerns, absolutely, about world population. So you shouldn't have too many children. But on the other hand, just to look after number one and say, you know, I want to live my life and children don't fit in it. There were certainly people around like that, but they were generally regarded with a certain amount of social disapproval.
Yes. And I think, if I'm honest, I don't think much of that has changed. I read a really interesting piece, I think it was on the BBC a few years ago, where they interviewed a whole series of people who had chosen not to have children, and how it's the kind of, they described it as the kind of the final taboo. You know, people think that you're kind of, as you say, selfish or lazy or, you know, don't want to contribute to society. And they said, well, hang on, I don't judge other people having children, knock yourself out, but just personally, it's not for me. Why should that choice be so kind of derided or treated with contempt? So I think there is still a degree of stigma towards people who have kind of voluntarily just say, not for me, thank you.
But now the antinatalist movement is turning this on its head. It's saying, no, you're the selfish ones. You're the thoughtless, selfish ones bringing extra mouths into the world. You know, we are the responsible ones seeing how terrible the future is and feeling it's not appropriate.
That's right. And so antinatalism doesn't just say, you know, some people don't want to have children and that's okay. It says, no, actually having children is immoral. Having children is a bad thing. Nobody should be having children. And so ultimately, I guess in the long term, their desire is to see humanity itself kind of go extinct.
Well, at its most extreme, I think that only represents an extreme fringe. There certainly are people who seriously arguing that the best thing for the planet would be for Homo sapiens to go extinct, that we are a terrible, predatory, destructive species, and it would rest best for everyone, all the other species, if this particular species topped itself and became extinct. I think that's an extreme view. I think many people have a less extreme view that would say, we're not necessarily saying there should be no children, we're just saying there should be radically fewer children brought into the world.
And one of the biggest reasons people give for this is environmental, isn't it? Is this the fear that the growth in population is the kind of primary driver of climate change, and we won't be able to, you know, restore the natural environment and prevent further damage to the earth if we don't kind of limit the size of the global population, and that's going to mean a lot of people having a lot fewer children or even no children at all, which is not a totally like bizarre fringe belief. I mean, I've talked to people around my own age who have said very similar things. You know, they might not use the word antinatalist, but have said, you know, I basically don't think I want to have kids because it doesn't seem like it would be a good idea for the climate.
Yeah, and there is this ecological concept that any particular context of population, there is has a carrying capacity. There's a maximum number of a species which can exist in an ecological niche, and if you exceed that species, you get disaster. And so people have tried to do this to the planet Earth. They said, what is the carrying capacity of the planet? And interestingly, when I looked at this previously, my memory is that the ecologists had come up with a figure of 1 to 2 billion as being the carrying capacity of the planet Earth in terms of the number of species Homo sapiens who could happily coexist with all the other species on the planet. And unfortunately, we're at 7 to 8 billion and rising, and therefore we need to somehow get back to the carrying capacity.
Is there good science to back up this idea? I mean, the cynic in me says, you know, for hundreds of years, going all the way back to someone like Malthus, you know, who is a kind of 18th century clergyman who developed these ideas about kind of demographic collapse because of excessive competition. And, you know, I'm sure the numbers that he would have said were the maximum are, again, orders of magnitude less than we have today. And even as recently as, you know, when in the middle of the 20th century, there were warnings that the Earth couldn't feed more than 6 billion people. And yet here we are today at 8 billion. And yes, there is, of course, still famine and hunger, but it is radically less than it was when we were at 5 billion, let alone worse. If it seems to me that people are always setting a limit, we burst through that limit and we discover actually human beings have ingeniously found ways to continue to support ever-growing numbers of people on the same finite resources.
Yeah, it is actually quite an interesting discussion, because what is often said is that there must be a limited number of resources on the planet, you know, limited amounts of metals, you know, particularly rare earths and other kind of the resources required for civilization. And once we've used up all those resources, then disaster looms. But in fact, what history shows is that as resources become scarce, more and more effort is put into finding more resources. And so far, that's always been successful. So even when it comes to rare earths, actually, you know, they exist in all sorts of places across the planet, but they just haven't yet been explored or mined. I mean, in Ukraine...
Something that's been previously too difficult or expensive to do, necessity is the mother invention. And we find that, you know, there's lithium in seawater. And if we can find a way to get the lithium out of seawater, then suddenly our lithium shortage is solved forever.
Exactly right. And so, you know, people say, well, what about drinking water? Well, we're running out of drinking water. But the truth is we can use electricity to desalinate the seas. And so, again, I think from a Christian point of view, I just get this impression that God has so richly endowed this planet with the potential for supporting human, and including human civilization, that this kind of scarcity mindset is just not realistic, and therefore there seems to be no reason why the planet couldn't support 9 billion, 10 billion, 11 billion, 12 billion if it was appropriately, if resources were appropriately used. And with, of course, there are, of course, issues about justice and equity and all the rest, but it's not as though we're running out. The planet is fundamentally running out.
And indeed, as we discussed at length last week, what we know, which people didn't know 60, 70 years ago, is that the population is not going to spiral ever higher and higher. In fact, you know, you can look at the decline in birth rates. The global birth rate is barely above replacement rate right now. So actually, most serious demographers predict that we'll probably hit about 10 billion at some point in this century, and then it will level off. And if things don't turn around, it will, if the fertility rates continue to fall, it will start to decline. So we're not going to see, as people feared they did 50 years ago, that this graph would just go on up and up and up, exponentially increasing forever. It's actually not the case at all.
That's right. I mean, obviously, you know, we come to the very controversial issue of climate change and whether, and particularly carbon dioxide levels, and you know, that the more humanity there is, the more that carbon dioxide is going to increase, the more that we are going to end up with environmental catastrophe. But I think, again, the evidence suggests that there are many things. Yes, it's true climate change is a reality, but there are many things that can be done to mitigate, using technology to mitigate the consequences of climate change, and therefore the doom and gloom that says there is ecological catastrophe staring us in the face, I genuinely think is not justified.
There's a related idea you might come across called degrowth, which says that the fundamental problem behind climate change is the desire that everyone has for their economies to grow and for us to produce more stuff and consume more stuff, which is, you know, previously on all sides, left and right, been seen as an obvious universal good. Obviously, we want our societies to grow. And actually, there are some more kind of radical parts of the green movement which say, no, degrowth should be the ambition. We have enough. We need to start to shrink our economies. We need to shut down our factories. We need to make less stuff, use less stuff. And that is how we will cut our carbon emissions. And I mean, I'm laying my cards on the table. I think it's entirely economically illiterate. And studies have shown actually that the kind of energy intensity of each kind of unit of population growth or unit economy has been decreasing for years. So our economies are bigger today than they've ever been, and yet they use less energy than they did before. And that trajectory will only continue. But also, actually, you won't be able to solve the problem without both economic growth, producing the resources that we need to, as you say, invest in technology and mitigate climate change. But also without the people, without the brain power, without the human resources we need. So it's certainly true on a kind of arid mathematical level. The best thing you can do to cut your household emissions is not to have any children, because, you know, every extra child consumes extra resources, et cetera. But actually, if we all start doing that, I don't think we produce the generation that's actually going to help us solve the problem.
Well, and of course, if I don't have a child and that allows me to run a Ferrari instead, I'm not necessarily reducing...
And go on expensive holidays overseas and all that.
Exactly.
Stuff.
Cruises and all the rest, and take to my private jet. I'm not necessarily reducing emissions. No.
There's a different, slightly more philosophical idea behind some antinatalists, which is less about the impact that new children will have on the environment and more about the idea of suffering, that to live is to suffer. And knowing that you are, when you create a child, you are creating a new sentient being that has the capacity to suffer over, you know, 70, 80, 90 years of life. And that, to do that, particularly without the consent of the child, because no one can give consent to be born, is in itself an immoral act. Have you come across this idea before?
Yeah, and in fact, it has got a sort of quirky popularity, a sort of fringe philosophy. There's a philosopher called David Benatar who wrote a book, an entire book called Better Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence. And the whole argument is based, as you say, on the net amount of pleasure versus suffering that there is in an average life. And if the net amount of suffering on balance is greater than the net amount of pleasure, then frankly, it's better not to exist at all. I mean, what I find very interesting about this is in many ways, this is closely related to the ancient Eastern ideas of Hinduism and Buddhism, you know, where the idea is that life consists of a cycle of suffering. Only because of reincarnation, you can't get out of it. Just ceasing to exist means you only come back again. So the only way to get out of this continual suffering of existence is by achieving nirvana, in some way to transcend the cycle of suffering. So, but it's got a similar kind of pessimistic feel that life, that existence itself is just a constant exposure to suffering.
Well, here's a question for you. You say it might have roots in Hinduism or Buddhism. Did you know the writer of Ecclesiastes was a crypto antinatalist? Here's some verses from chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is the one who has never been born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun.
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? That's that trend that is in the wisdom literature, that deeply pessimistic and world-weary philosophy. Interestingly, in Ecclesiastes, it's the outcome of an attempt at hedonism, isn't it? This is a guy who tries to experience every possible pleasure that the world has to offer,
and it's all empty and meaningless.
And comes to the conclusion that it's all. So it's not that he starts like saying this is just reality. And in that sense, it's that sense of disillusionment that the excesses of hedonism cannot provide meaning. Mm. And of course, the biblical commentators have waxed lyrical as to why this is there in the biblical canon, but it does illustrate, doesn't it, that the Bible does take seriously the that some lives are full of suffering, that suffering is a reality and sometimes an inexplicable reality. Because of course we've also got the Book of Job, haven't we, and the suffering there that.
And Job says he wishes he'd never been born. I think at one point, doesn't he?
He does.
And I think it's about, as you say, about the radical honesty of Scripture and saying these are, you know, there might be a surge of interest in antinatalism today, but it's not like it's been invented 5 years ago. These are deep currents and ideas and trains of thought that lots of people over many, many years in different cultures and at different times have come to. And I think it's easy for us as Christians to be like, haha, what a silly idea. Do you want people to go extinct? But actually fail to grapple with the quite a lot of thought that some of these antinatalists have gone to. You know, I mean, just to sometimes to quite kind of amusing extent. I don't know if you saw this story from a few years ago, 2019. 27-year-old Indian man plans to sue his parents for giving birth to him without his consent. Mumbai businessman Raphael Samuel told the BBC that it was wrong to bring children into the world because they then had to put up with lifelong suffering. As we didn't ask to be born, he says we should be paid for the rest of our lives to live. So I think, I think this is a publicity stunt, and he's a kind of Indian antinatalist. I think he was suing his parents, who took it, I have to say, with remarkable equanimity. his mum said, I must admire my son's temerity to want to take his parents to court, knowing both of us are lawyers. And if Raphael could come up with a rational explanation as to how we could have sought his consent to be born, I will accept my fault, his mother said. So I think, it's a tongue-in-cheek kind of publicity stunt. But these are often quite serious people trying to draw attention to what they think is quite a serious idea. And I think it's important that we don't just knee-jerk dismiss it as obviously foolish.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, and I was just looking at an article where it reported a survey of young people who, many of whom, because this kind of attitude, I think, is much more common amongst the young and sort of Gen Z, and they listed six of the most common reasons deterring 18 to 34 year olds from having children. And the commonest reason, interestingly, was more time to focus on myself. Secondly, financial issues. And then fears about the state of the world and concerned about the impact on the environment. Number four. Number five, prioritizing career aspirations. And then six, existing health issues, which is also an interesting one. So it's be interesting just to look at that list, isn't it? And perhaps not surprisingly, the commonest reason is more time to focus on myself. That having a child, becoming a parent, quite rightly is understood as being a radically unselfish, forces unselfishness. And certainly that'll be my experience, and I'm sure you'd say the same, that once you become a parent, you suddenly discover this ability to completely focus on my own wishes and desires and how to live my own life is suddenly a coach and horses is driven through it.
No, it's very true. And I think this, and we've touched on this, didn't we, last time, talking about the reasons people are having fewer children, there is this sense of a growing sense of individualism, the idea that, you know, your greatest responsibility is to kind of fulfill your potential, to find who you truly are and express that in all its special uniqueness. And having children does, to an extent, cut against that, because actually people, as you say, people correctly identify that if you have children, you can't focus all your time and effort on growing your particular capabilities and your special uniqueness and expressing that in all its wonder. You are instead pouring all that effort and energy into another and helping a child grow and discover who they are and flourish in that sense. And yeah,
so I can understand.
I think it's... I mean, I agree, it's good for us, but I think it does cut against the grain, doesn't it?
It certainly does. But I've sometimes speculated, you know, what would have happened to me if I'd remained as a single man or even married without children. And I think, you know, I would have been even more selfish and self-centred and self-preoccupied than I am already. But the experience of being becoming a father has been is constantly challenged and cut across my selfish tendencies, and that actually, to be honest, has been good for me, just in my individual personal development and growth. And sometimes, not always by any means, but sometimes when one meets single people, one just senses this sense of self preoccupation which being single allows you to do.
I mean, this has reminded me a bit of our conversation. Do you remember we talked to Ed Shaw on the podcast a while back, who is a single guy, same sex attracted, and now he was talking in about some of the ways in which the church and evangelical culture can kind of accidentally idolize marriage, and actually there are some benefits to being single, kind of spiritual benefits to being single. But I'm sure he said as well, there are also kind of prevailing temptations and dangers. And just like there are, you know, there are ways in which being married and becoming parents can foster unhealthy, unchristian attitudes in us, is absolutely the case that it can also be a profoundly sanctifying effect. And there are massive dangers and temptations and prevailing patterns of sinful behavior that people who don't have kids can fall into. Not that it's universal, absolutely not. We're not suggesting for a second that if you don't have children, you're fundamentally a selfish person. But it is quite sobering to see that, you know, by far the largest reason why 18 to 34-year-olds don't want children is to, quote, have more time to focus on myself. And I think that should give us pause.
I think absolutely it should. And what strikes me is that if you go back into Christian history and its celebration of celibacy, which goes all the way back to Jesus himself as a celibate man, Paul, and celebrating his celibacy, and then all the way through early church history, celibacy was seen as a liberation which allowed you to be there for others. You know, the single person could be completely available to others, could give their life in utter unselfishness because they didn't have the preoccupations of wife and family and everything involved that comes with it. And certainly, you know, I have met single Christians like that, both male and female, who demonstrate an extraordinary level of selflessness, that their celibacy allows them to be totally invested in the lives of others. So it's paradoxical, isn't it, that here it's seen not as an opportunity to invest in the life of others, but as a way to focus on number one.
That is interesting. I mean, you hear some similar arguments when, for example, like the Catholic Church justifies the need for kind of priestly celibacy. And part of their case is, I mean, part of it is modeling the priests on the life of Jesus. But part of it is also this idea that, well, if a priest had a wife and children, he would have understandable obligations and duties and responsibilities and distractions to care for them. Whereas actually the vocation of a priest in Catholicism is to be a kind of father to the flock, to your entire parish, to your congregation, to your community, to serve them in a kind of holistic 24/7 way. And that's why they need to be freed of these kind of like worldly encumbrances so that they can focus on being, you know, married to the church effectively.
Well, and to be honest, I saw that in John Stott. He was a single man who was able to pour himself into relationships with people literally around the world. I mean, he had this network of deep, intimate friendships and of those he was counselling, supporting, caring. And it was his singleness which allowed him to do that. So I think celebrating the positive side of celibacy, but not equating celibacy with selfishness, I think that's really important.
And I think it's also important to note that while a lot of Christians today would kind of instinctively feel that Christianity is a profoundly kind of child-focused, pro-family ethic, there's actually been large parts of church history going all the way back, as you say, to the New Testament, which have had quite a different approach. I mean, Paul explicitly says, doesn't he, in one of the epistles, I wish all could be like me, i.e. single and childless. But, you know, for those who aren't called to this, you know, here is some guidance on how you can live well as parents and husbands and wives. And then, you know, you have the growth of the monastic movement starting, you know, only a few hundred years after Christ, and kind of culminating, as we said, with priestly celibacy. And there was a strong strain of thought in kind of Christendom era that the truly holy people, the really super spiritual people, of course, they would be single, they would be childless, they would be devoted to God. But we understand this is a higher calling, a higher way of life that, you know, most people won't be able to face up to. Whereas I think now we see the other way around. I think we say, gosh, how awful that a few minority won't be able to get married like the rest of us, and God will have to be with them in their long, lonely walk through singleness and childlessness.
Absolutely. And of course, that's why it's very striking that Jesus was perfect humanity as it was intended to be, and yet was a single man, and that he became the model. And therefore, it would be true to say that New Testament Christianity is much less sort of family focused than the American evangelical right tends to imply. You know, that in fact, you could argue that Jesus had an ambivalent relationship with his own family, that he was not always the dutiful son who was supporting family values.
No, I mean, there's a famous moment, isn't there? Is it in Mark's gospel, Matthew's gospel, where he's, you know, teaching at a house and gathering a crowd, and his mother and his brothers come to try and say, oh, don't worry, he's out of his mind. We'll take him back to Nazareth. Sorry to bother you. Don't worry. Come along, Jesus. And he says, and they come and say, oh, Jesus, your mother and your family are outside. Do you want to go? And he's like, who are my mother? Who are my family? You people who follow me, people who do the Lord's will, those are my true family. So this is quite almost radical, revolutionary anti-family sentiment, which says your true kin are not those you have blood ties to. Your true kin are those who are followers on the way, who are in your church family, who are your brothers and sisters in Christ, are in effect your true brothers and sisters rather than the ones you were raised with.
And I think it was also true that in the early church, there was such a expectation that Christ would return. But also there were going to be times of great distress and tribulation that many Christians came to the conclusion that it was probably better not to get married and not to have children.
No, that's true, yeah. A kind of premillennial antinatalism, we could call it. The rapture is coming, so why would you weigh yourself down with some squawking infants when we need to be, you know, ready for Christ's return? And again, it's easy to kind of chuckle about this stuff, but you can see in the background of a lot of the New Testament, in the Pauline epistles and others, you can see there is a lot of Christians took this stuff very, very seriously. And again, Paul is having to write to a lot of these churches and kind of try and give them some kind of guidance about why you should or shouldn't be having children, and should married couples abstain from sex, and if so, for what reasons and for how long, and all this stuff. Like, this is a very live issue. And I think it's interesting that it's become so detached from the mainstream Christian conversation that we all just take for granted, of course, everyone should who is married should try and have children. No questions asked.
Yeah, so just going back to the reasons given by young people. So number one was more time to focus on myself. Number two is financial issues. We mentioned this, didn't we? Again, the cost of child rearing is seen as massive. So over £100,000 in lifetime costs of having a child. And therefore, is it worth it? I mean, you know, does it make economic sense? It's a kind of hard-headed financial return. What's the return on investment? You know, if I spend £100,000, you know, think what I could do with £100,000.
Yeah. And you know, We I think, if I seem to recall, we slightly kind of poo-pooed the idea that the high cost of nursery was behind the decline in birth rates, noting that some countries have tried to put in kind of sweeping subsidies and financial support, and it hasn't made much long-term impact on the decline in children being born. But I think it speaks to a general sense of precariousness, a sense of scarcity that particularly the young, you know, the kind of 35 and under group might feel, that even if it's not directly tied to, you know, climate crisis, there is certainly a kind of pessimism, a despair, a gloom about the future, that the kind of bright, shiny optimism and idealism of modernism, that we're building towards something better, every generation is going to have it better than the one before, that is pretty much gone, hasn't it?
Well, this is really interesting, isn't it? Because I suspect that this cuts to the certainly one of the most important features, and it came as number three in the list, was fears about the state of the world. And I think that is true. Apparently, historically, if you look back, you know, over centuries, whenever there is a period of real unrest and uncertainty, birth rates drop. And then once, you know, like, for instance, in wartime, it's common, not surprisingly, the birth rates drop. But then when there's peace and recovery, then historically birth rates have rocketed back. I mean, that's the origin of the baby boomers, isn't it? You know, I was born in 52, which was just sort of classic baby boomer territory after the Second World War. So the argument goes, you know, here we are in 2025. We are at a time of extraordinary geopolitical uncertainty, conflict, you know, the breakdown of the post-war rules-based order. As we speak, financial markets are being roiled, as they say.
Yeah. And, you know, assumptions about alliances and free trade and stuff being ripped up in real time by Donald Trump. in the midst of, you know, the first major land war in Europe for generations, I think it's, in one sense, it's quite rational to look at that and say, things seem uncertain, things seem scary. Having a child is fundamentally a vote of faith, a confidence in the future. You have a child because you think that there will be a future for this child to grow up into. And even if people don't literally think the world's going to come to an end in the next 20 or 30 years, I think you're absolutely right. A sense of pessimism and gloom about the future is only going to depress birth rates and only going to make some people think, you know, what is the point of investing the hundreds of thousands of pounds it takes and the, you know, tens of thousands of hours it takes to raise a child if there isn't going to be much of a world for them to grow up into.
And thinking about it, if in particular, as I'm thinking of the future, I'm bringing a baby into the world, it's, I need to have confidence in the next 18 years, don't I? Because it's the next 18 years when I'm going to be responsible to care, pay for, protect this little being. And can I have confidence that I'm going to have a salary for the next 18 years? Can I have confidence that I'm going to have somewhere to live? Can I have confidence that I'm going to be able to create a secure environment for a child? And I think you could see why some people would say, well, actually, looking around, looking at my employment prospects, looking at what's happening to Britain, you know, what happens when China invades Taiwan? What happens when Russia invades Poland? You know, can I really be confident that I'm going to be able to raise a child over the next 18 years?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, should we come to an end thinking about Christian responses to the kind of trend of antinatalism? Like I said, a lot of Christians will just instinctively say, well, of course, Christians are pronatal people, end of discussion. It, should we dig a bit deeper than that? Are there any good Christian reasons to be antinatalist?
Well, I think there are good reasons to be celibate. I think that, you know, as we said before, to me, it's a real sadness that whereas, you know, going back 50 years, celibacy was seen amongst young people, Christian young people, as a very viable option, as something to say, you know what, I think for me personally, I'm going to dedicate my life to Christ and as a single person. That option seems to be almost disappeared now. I mean, it's almost by definition, somebody who hasn't got married is that they're a saddo in some way. There's some massive deficiency in their life, which is, that is not, I think, an authentically Christian understanding.
No. And that really, I think, you know, you have to wind the clock all the way back to kind of, you know, church youth groups and start the work there. You know, I think about how so much of the culture when I was growing up in the noughties in kind of church evangelical youth culture was talking about, you know, are you praying for your future spouse? And, you know, are you going to wear a purity ring to commit to your future spouse and not to have sex? And it was just taken for granted that everyone was on a trajectory towards getting married. And there was never any injection into conversation that, A, some of you might want to get married, but it might not happen for a variety of reasons. And how do we talk and think about that? Where is God in that? But also, some of you might actively choose not to get married and have children. And that's also a deeply faithful choice to make. There was no, and so I think if we want to start to rewire how the church thinks about this stuff, we probably do have to start all the way back with the early teenagers and talking to them about when we do our, you know, sex ed stuff, also talk about singleness and about celibacy and about the honored position that that way of life has had in Christian tradition and how we want to resurrect some of that today.
Yeah, I think that's right. And of course, that's deeply countercultural when compared to this sort of family orientated culture, although it's interesting, isn't it? It may be becoming less countercultural because of the rise of the singleness, the single households. But of course, it's for very different reasons. The Christian reason for being single is not so I can look after number one. It is all about so that I can, as a gift, the gift of singleness, to serve others, you know, within the body. Yeah. To commit myself to sacrificial service.
As you say, celibate singleness, childlessness is in one sense, less countercultural now than it has been for maybe thousands of years. But in other ways, we do actually want to stand against at large elements of that culture. You know, you think about the trends in places like Japan or South Korea, where they have whole words for people who kind of check out and just spend their life in their apartments, subsisting on takeaways and opting out of kind of human relationships because it's too complicated. They never have partners. They never, just live online and video game. That is a profoundly anti-Christian worldview, not something we want to be leaning into. And yet at the same time, as you say, there is something countercultural about saying, I'm going to choose to be single, choose to be to give up the chance of having children, not so that I can turn in on myself, but so that I can be more fully available to be more community minded.
Yes, and then there's another countercultural possibility, which some single Christian people are doing, and that is to adopt a child and choose to become a parent by adopting a child who's already here in the world. And I think that's, again, a very interesting and positive development that, that is definitely viable, but provided there is the community to support the individual, because of course becoming a single parent is no desperately demanding, as we both know. It's bad enough when you've got two parents.
Yes. Yeah. No. I mean, I'm sometimes struck by the almost inconceivableness of trying to do this solo, which obviously people do, and not just with one child sometimes, but two, three, or four. I mean, in some ways, I've often reflected that me and Jess, my wife, we have become almost unintentional antinatalists in that, you know, we have one child who's adopted, and we both feel relatively confident that, you know, should we grow our family, we would do it through adoption again. And that's not because we've experienced infertility, but because we think that's what God is calling us to do, is to forego the chance of having biological children, but instead adopt. And I don't think that's particularly necessarily a very common thing to do, but in some sense, it does cut against the idea that some Christians have, which is that, you know, every married couple has a kind of duty. You know, they interpret that kind of mandate in Genesis to be fruitful and multiply, that is a moral duty on all married Christians to have biological children, which you can maybe top them up down the line with some adopted ones if you want to as a humanitarian effort. So there is a tension there, whereas I think me and Jess would understand the point of a marriage is to be fruitful, and we can be fruitful not solely by expanding our family biologically, but also by welcoming in, you know, vulnerable children who need new parents.
Yes, and that is an act of grace, isn't it? And we've talked about this before, that I think it's a helpful distinction to think about. Normally having children is really an act of creation. It comes from the created order. It comes from the way that God has made us. Whereas when we choose to adopt children, this is an act of grace. This is a Christian response. It is... In that sense, you know, a celibate person who chooses celibacy in order to be giving to others and then chooses to adopt a child, it seems a very natural way of giving care and protection and support to a child who desperately needs it.
And we have sometimes, I should stress, very much with tongues firmly placed in cheeks, joked about the idea that actually adoption is a way of almost having your cake and eating it, because, you know, our daughter was already in the world, so we haven't contributed any more climate change emissions. We haven't contributed any greater strain on the Earth's carrying capacity, but we get to be parents and have all the fulfillment and enjoyment of raising a family anyway. And so it's the most environmentally sustainable way to have children.
Whereas, alas, Tim, we were deeply, deeply environmentally...
Yes.
Irresponsible, bringing three mouths into the world. I mean, you just
in this economy,
think of all that extra CO2 for which we are responsible.
Yeah, and the hot air pumped out by this podcast is no doubt contributing to it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I'll launch a lawsuit against you, like that Indian guy. It might shock you to discover I'm actually grateful to be alive. I don't blame you at all for introducing me into the world without seeking my consent first. I think it was a great idea.
Well, that's reassuring. So I think we should draw this rapidly to a close.
Yeah, but I think just in closing, I think, you know, fundamentally Christianity, I don't think, is an antinatalist philosophy, an antinatalist faith. But I think it would be, as you say, there's a way of turning this conversation. And maybe the next time, you know, we find ourselves talking to friends who aren't Christians, who are expressing worries about the state of the world and the future and the ethicalness of having children, rather than kind of saying, how foolish, and going back to your 2.2 children and your golden Labrador at home, is to maybe draw that conversation onto, you know, isn't it interesting that at many times lots of Christians have chosen not to have children, and what can we pull out of that that might have some kind of resonance and wisdom for us in 21st century life?
Yeah, but I think drawing it to a close, I think what I would say is that in order to bring children into the world, you have to have hope. You have to believe, you have to have something that you hope for. And what antinatalism is really reflecting is the loss of hope, is a kind of despair, a world-weary despair.
It's nihilistic almost, isn't it?
It is nihilistic. And in that sense, philosophically, of course, it is the outcome of, you know, the trends that started in the Enlightenment. You know, once you lose this sense of a wider cosmic order, and you say we are creating order and we are choosing, then that could very easily slip into a kind of despair, a hopelessness, a nihilism that then says, well, why on earth bring children into the world? I mean, interestingly, it either leads into that nihilistic, or it goes the other way into a kind of techno-optimism that says we are going to invent meaning, and we're going to use technology to do it, and we're going to colonize Mars, and we're going to spread our seed across the universe. And it's based on a kind of soft nihilism. There isn't any meaning. There isn't any ultimate meaning to the universe, but we are going to impose our own crazy idea onto the universe.
Yeah. And I actually say that one of the few elements of the antinatalist critique that I do find compelling is the idea that some antinatalists say, which is that having children, parents have children, make them means rather than ends. You know, they have children to make themselves feel happy. They have children to provide for themselves in retirement. They have children because it's, you know, culturally embarrassing for them if they don't. And actually that is disrespectful to the child, who should be an end, not a means in themselves. And actually in that sense, I would entirely agree. The answer is not to have children. The answer is to have children for someone other than yourself. And in that sense, what Elon Musk is doing and the kind of, you know, colonize Mars natalism is not really about saying we want to bring more children into the world so that more individual beings created in the image of an infinite God can exist to his glory. It's saying because we think they will help us buttress our society and, you know, enable us to become an interplanetary species or whatever other grand ideology I might need to sustain. And actually, the Christian theology, the Christian ethic of having children, says we have children not to further our own interests, but because, as you say, we have hope for a future, and because we think it's a good in and of itself.
Yeah, and I suspect that, you know, as these things evolve, these different philosophies, that this is one way in which Christians will be increasingly countercultural. In that we will be the procreative part of society.
Minority,
and it's interesting how some secular people have looked with horror at this prospect, you know, that what's going to happen is from their perspective, all the right-thinking secularists are going to die out, and it's these weird religious minorities that are going to populate the earth because they're the only ones having children.
And this ties into the idea we touched on briefly last week about that, you know, Western secular liberalism is a multi-generational death cult that is sowing the seeds of its own demise, because as people come to adopt that philosophy, they have fewer and fewer children, and eventually the philosophy will die out when its last adherent dies with no kids. Whereas the minority groups which are thriving or growing are those that have a very clear sense of what the future is coming, what they're for, and whether that is, you know, Haredi Jews in Israel who have on average, you know, four or five kids and are growing at a large rate, or maybe evangelical Christians in the secularizing West.
Yeah, and I often come back to that bit at the end of Deuteronomy where Moses gives his final speech to the children of Israel, and he warns them of all the, he sets before them these two possible futures of blessings and cursings, of life and death. And he then says, therefore, choose life.
Choose life.
That you and your children may live. And that is ultimately the Christian response. Yes, there is death, there is, but we make a choice to say we choose life.
Yeah. And as you say, that might become a more and more profound witness in a culture which is increasingly overtaken by gloom and despair about the future, Christians stubbornly holding on to hope. Not naively, not saying that we're blind to climate catastrophe or to political instability or war or pandemic, but to say that despite all of that, we continue to have children, we continue to look forward to the future with hope, because we have confidence in a God who is bigger than Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin or COVID-19.
Amen. Well said.
Amen. Well, let's draw it to a close there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope that was an interesting conversation to stimulate your own thinking. We'd love to know your thoughts on antinatalism. Have you decided not to have children because of any of the reasons we discussed or other reasons? We'd love to hear from you. Please do get in touch. Or if you have any suggestions of things, ideas we should talk about, news stories we should respond to, scientific developments and discoveries we could talk about on the podcast, we'd love to look through all your suggestions. And a lot of them do end up inspiring these very episodes. So you can email us, molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. You also go to Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, where there's lots of talks and writing and resources and videos. And you can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I would point you towards my Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, a weekly read on what is going on in the church world. That's all. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.